So we're going to move on and talk about endometrial cancer, one of our virtual mini modules. We have Dr. Shannon Wesson from MD Anderson. How are you doing today, Shannon?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, it used to be we didn't have too much to talk about with endometrial cancer. Now we've got a lot to talk about. Particularly what we want you to focus on is the issue of checkpoint inhibitors, because that really has changed the whole approach to these patients. And before you get into your talk, because we asked you to talk about the issue of using lenvatinib, pembrolizumab, in patients with MS stable disease, before you go through that story, because there's a lot to that, maybe just to take a breath back and talk a little bit about your vision for where IOs fit into endometrial cancer management. And from your point of view, what are the key biomarkers or clinical issues that you need to look at before making a treatment recommendation?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And I agree with you. It's so wonderful to be able to have options like this for our patients with endometrial cancer, where previously we were just using kind of standard chemotherapy with very minimal activity. The bottom line is, as of right now, IO immuno-oncology agents should be used in the second line. However, we are moving them into the front line. There are a number of large randomized phase three trials that are already completed or ongoing that will answer the question of, should we bring IO into the front line, either as a single agent or in combination with chemotherapy, or in combination with lenvatinib, which we're going to talk a little bit about in just a minute. For now, endometrial cancer, the biomarker of interest is MSI. So for a patient with microsatellite instability high or mismatch repair deficient tumor, immune oncology agents, checkpoint inhibitors as a single agent are appropriate in the second line, and to be determined what that marker will mean in the front line once these trials read out. Conversely, for those patients that are mismatch repair proficient or microsatellite stable, that's where the combination of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab has been the most active.
So we asked you to review that, but first, can you comment a little bit about the approach to MSI disease? Of course, in colon cancer, that's now moved into first-line therapy. Coming out of colon cancer was the thought that maybe MSI tumors are not as chemo-sensitive. I don't know whether you think that applies to endometrial cancer, but curious whether you think ideally it should be used in the first line. And whenever it is used, what do you consider optimal hormonal therapy, IO therapy? Is single agent IO optimal? What about anti-CTLA-4 combinations? Thoughts about that? Combination of IO plus chemotherapy? Where do you see MSI heading?
Yeah. So, you know, at this point, for early stage, we can still cure them with surgery. And often we're not even exploring immuno-oncology agents there. However, there are some trials that are adding checkpoint inhibition to radiation therapy. So for early stage disease with MSI, adding that agent to radiation to potentially accentuate that. So that's one opportunity. In advanced and recurrent disease is really where we're seeing the biggest push. Right now, here and now today, you can really only use it in the second line, and that includes either pembrolizumab or just tarlumab, which both have FDA approvals for patients with microsatellite instability high disease. However, essentially any checkpoint inhibitor that you can think of is in a trial combined with chemotherapy in the upfront setting. And so over the next probably year or 2 years, we're going to start seeing those data read out and see if it's appropriate to add checkpoint inhibition to chemotherapy. And if so, is it appropriate for all comers, or is it only appropriate for those with the biomarker? And then I would just mention, because we were all very interested in the colorectal data that were presented at ASCO, that we do have a trial that's ongoing for patients with microsatellite instability high advanced stage, either stage 3 or 4, or even recurrent disease. If they have an MSI high, they're being randomized to either chemo, which would be the standard of care, versus immune checkpoint inhibition. So that will answer the question of, can we get rid of chemotherapy for patients with MSI high?
What about neoadjuvant IO? You know, we're going to talk later on in the GI session. We saw the, you know, New York Times worthy part on the small rectal study, but also upper GI cancer, really great data on neoadjuvant IO. Is that being considered in endometrial?
You know, it hasn't been yet, but I suspect if we see some of these trials coming back positive, that it will. You know, neoadjuvant chemotherapy and endometrial is really a bunch of retrospective studies that support it. I mean, we don't have a lot of prospective data for that even at all. So I think that if we start seeing activity in these frontline studies that we expect to see, then I bet you we're going to see some things move into the neoadjuvant. I am aware there's some small trials in different institutions that are kind of using like an all-comers setting. So you'll have patients with colorectal, with GI, and we do have endometrial cancer patients included in those studies as well. So that may get at our answer.
So we've done a lot of webinars over the last couple of years on endometrial cancer. I feel like every time there's a case, particularly if they're going to get lenvatinib and pembro, it's a different issue. And you all really, and obviously this is a combination being looked at in other cancers, but you all have the most experience with it. And I'm curious, maybe you can review for us how you approach the use of this therapy.
Yeah, definitely. So let me get started. You know, I'm going to talk about lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. I am going to cover a little bit of background, although we've touched on it already in the discussion with Dr. Love. But I think the bottom line is this is the cancer genome atlas data that really changed our perspective around endometrial cancer, where we have been treating it as one disease. Now we know it's really more like four based on clear molecular differences. And even more importantly, when we're talking about this, we still treat it the same. We're still giving paclitaxel and carboplatin. So there's a lot of room for improvement. So what we've started thinking is, can we use these four different molecular classifications to determine who might benefit from immune oncology agents? And what we found is two of the molecular subtypes, the poly ultramutated and the microsatellite instability high hypermutated, seem to be so-called hot tumors that will respond better to immune oncology agents. Conversely, there's work to be done for the copy number low group and the copy number high group, where immune agents don't seem to work as well. So what do we know about biomarker-guided therapy? As I already mentioned, we have a clear indication to utilize checkpoint inhibition as a single agent for patients with microsatellite instability high disease or mismatch repair deficient. The first study that looked at this was KEYNOTE-158, large proportion of patients with endometrial cancer, almost 50, and the response rate was 57% for those patients with endometrial cancer. They had 1 to 2 prior lines of therapy. The duration of response and the median progression-free survival were over 2 years. So this was extremely exciting. And we saw consistent data across the different checkpoint inhibitors. So not only with pembrolizumab, but durvalumab, dostarlimab, and avelumab. And only pembrolizumab and dostarlimab currently have an FDA approval here. Now, when we look at the other side of the coin, those patients with the non-biomarker selected or mismatch repair proficient disease, that's where we have room to improve. So the response rates to single agent checkpoint inhibition are fairly low, really not that exciting. And so that led to the exploration of combination strategies. So KEYNOTE-146 was the first large study that looked at the combination of lenvatinib with pembrolizumab, again, in endometrial cancer with 1 to 2 prior lines of therapy. And they broke it out based on biomarker, although the majority of patients were not MSI high and did not have mismatch repair deficiency. And they were treated up to 35 cycles with the combination. The primary endpoint was overall response, and they met their primary endpoint. In the group that was not mismatch repair deficient or not MSI high, the response rate was 37%, including multiple patients with complete responses, which is basically unheard of in this disease. And so that was super exciting and moved forward as an FDA accelerated approval. I do want to note that they did tease this out both by MSI status and histology. And you can see PD-1, L1 status didn't have an impact. Mismatch repair status didn't have an impact. The CRs were actually in patients without the biomarker. And further, they saw activity across all the different histology subtypes, including the most aggressive clear cell and serous, which often don't respond to chemotherapy. It's important to note about toxicity. So what we saw, you know, there were a high proportion of patients with grade 3-4 adverse events, including hypertension, fatigue, and diarrhea. And they had about 57% had any grade immune oncology related adverse event, the most common being hypothyroidism. So you do have to be mindful of the safety concerns. So that was the accelerated approval, and Keynote 775 went on for the confirmatory approval. This was a randomized study in a similar population of 1 to 2 prior lines of therapy, randomized 1 to 1 to the combination of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab versus standard chemotherapy, including either doxorubicin or weekly paclitaxel. And the primary endpoints were PFS and overall survival. And bottom line is it met both. So lenvatinib and pembrolizumab improved progression-free survival and improved overall survival in both the all-comers population as well as in the group that was only mismatch repair proficient. So this was very exciting and confirmed that FDA approval. Now, similarly, we did see adverse events, and you can see the breakdown of the most common adverse events. Again, hypertension, hypothyroidism, diarrhea, fatigue, GI symptoms like nausea, vomiting, and appetite were all things that need to be followed. And so it comes down that we want to make sure we can manage these AEs so we can get our patients on the best therapy. I will note, as Dr. Love and I already spoke about, that there is an interest to get rid of chemo in the upfront. And so the LEAP-001 study is a first-line phase 3 study that is comparing paclitaxel and carboplatin to lenvatinib and pembrolizumab in a newly diagnosed stage 3-4 or untreated recurrent endometrial cancer population. So it'll be exciting to see if this combination gets rid of chemotherapy. So I'll just spend the last minute talking about prevention of these issues, because as you saw, there's high levels of grade 3-4 adverse events, and we want to make sure that we're getting out in front of it. So we want to appropriately select our patients using performance status, existing adverse events. We want to make sure we're taking care of them, and we're getting out in front of these adverse events and making sure they understand what to expect so that they can avoid having to stop treatment and move on to something else. I put this just as a reference for guidelines of managing AEs with immunotherapy, but I want to focus on kind of what we do. This is an awesome paper from Vicky Macker out of The Oncologist, where they basically showed when to expect these adverse events. You can see hypertension starts fairly early, proteinuria around the same time. GI happens a little bit later, about 4 weeks in, whereas some of the things like hypothyroidism and IO issues happen much later. So this helps you to kind of, again, counsel your patients. And this is what we do. So we do daily monitoring. We give patients a blood pressure monitor and have them give us a log of their blood pressures. We actually send them home with an antihypertensive script so that they have it, so that if they begin to develop blood pressure issues, we don't have to have them come all the way back in. For diarrhea, we encourage them to report right away. We don't want them to be reporting, oh yes, I had 8 bowel movements. We want to hear about it when they start, you know, just having a few. I'm going to make sure we consider the timeline and use adequate dose interruptions. Fatigue, just like anything, rule out other causes, encourage exercise, and frequent use of interruptions and reductions can help with that. And then finally, for nausea, we do send them with prophylactic antiemetics. If they begin to have nausea with their lenvatinib, then we have them start pre-medding at home with that and, you know, use the usual high-fat foods and small frequent meals to try to overcome that. So I believe that's my last slide, and I'm excited to get into the discussion.
So a lot of questions that come out related to this topic, and number one is dosing of lenvatinib. I hear a lot of different, you know, theoretically should be 20 milligrams. I hear people say 10 milligrams. Your colleague, Dr. O'Malley, who's coming on a while, says 18 milligrams, so he has different size pills to reduce. What about initial dosing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the data we have, you're exactly right, are for 20. I think a lot of people in practice are starting at kind of the dose level 1, which is 14, trying to avoid, you know, some of the side effects and kind of get out in front of it. You know, we generally do is we start at 20 for patients that have a really excellent performance status, not much other stuff going on, you know, not already on a lot of antihypertensives. You can really crafted around your patient, because those patients often will be able to stay on that 20 milligram dose and do quite well. Conversely, if you have a patient that's maybe on the borderline for performance status, already having some diarrhea, or already on multiple antihypertensives, that's where I really consider starting at a lower dose. But I do want to make a comment here, because I don't think we know the answer. What I don't know is, do we need that loading dose, right? That's why I hesitate to just go dose reduce right from the beginning, because perhaps you need that elevated loading dose to really get that benefit before you dose reduce. I mean, we don't have the answer to that question.
Any times where it gets difficult to figure out what a toxicity is from, whether it's the lenvatinib or the pembro, particularly diarrhea?
Yeah, some of it's the timing, right? You know, we don't expect immune oncology agents to start to impact diarrhea really until about kind of 6, 7, 8 weeks in, typically at the earliest. And so, you know, often if it's an early onset symptom, that's more consistent with the lenvatinib. But the other way, the kind of quick and dirty way to get to understand is stop the lenvatinib. Generally, if the diarrhea stops when you stop the lenvatinib, that's the cause. And then you can get on top of it with anti-motility agents. If that doesn't improve, that's when we would start to explore steroids and consider an immune relation.
You know, not every patient with MSI high, getting back to that, will respond to an IO. Any thoughts about lenvatinib pembro for MSI high, or a patient who's progressing on pembro adding in lenvatinib MSI high?
Yeah, I like the second option better. You know, I think we want to give them a chance to just have the, you know, single agent checkpoint inhibition is just better tolerated than the combination with lenvatinib. That's just the facts. And so if you can get control of your patient's disease and response with your patient without having to do the dual agents, it's going to be preferable for the most part. With that being said, I'm very interested and trying to potentially put some protocols on paper around this of, you know, in an organized fashion in a patient population that has a recurrence or progresses on single agent checkpoint, adding lenvatinib to try to overcome that resistance. I think it's very intriguing.
So a question from the audience in terms of what comes after second line lenvatinib, pembrolizumab, and MS stable disease. And certainly one of the issues is going to be going on a clinical trial, but any non-trial options? I want your thoughts on this new approach just presented recently at ASCO. But outside a trial setting right now, what do you do after lenvatinib pembro?
Yeah. So for you're 100% right. I'm always trying to put patients on trials as much as I can. We definitely use next gen sequencing. A lot of these patients have aberrations that can potentially be targeted, like RAS pathway aberrations, PI3 kinase pathway aberrations. So there are things that you could potentially utilize even as standard of care that have indications in other tumor types. I think we're starting to see a little bit more permissiveness there. For patients with endometrioid type or the ERPR, the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor driven, hormonal options are actually quite nice, alternating megestrol acetate and tamoxifen, utilizing everolimus and letrozole. Those all have shown some really nice response in prolonged stable disease, and patients tolerate it really well. So that's certainly, those are some very active options.
And actually, you know, we've seen some data. Just talking about CDK and the breast session, but we're starting to see a little bit of, you mentioned hormonal therapy. I think there have been a couple small studies looking at CDK. Do you see that coming into the low-grade ER-positive setting?
I do. Yeah, I think there's a number of trials that are exploring that. We actually have a triple trial with everolimus, letrozole, and ribociclib that we're very excited about what we're seeing. So I do think there's a possibility. You know, we often learn from our colleagues in breast, and that's why I was so glad to get to watch the group right before us, because we, you know, from the low grade standpoint, there's a lot we can potentially extrapolate. And I do think CDK4/6 inhibitors are going to be really exciting.
Yeah, the breast people learn a lot from you as well. What did you think about this paper? You know, selinexor is an agent that we've been talking about in myeloma for a while. We were talking about this morning, diffuse large B. So I think that the mechanism is really cool and different. I'm curious what your thoughts are about this agent, whether you think there's maybe some future for it in endometrial cancer.
Yeah, we saw a really nice paper looking at this agent in the maintenance setting. And certainly it makes sense because it seems like it may work better for patients with wild type P53, which is the bulk of patients with endometrial cancer, excluding the high copy number high group. And what they found, this was a randomized phase 3 trial, SIENDO, that randomized patients after they completed their upfront therapy to either selinexor or placebo, and they saw overall in the intention to treat population an improvement in progression-free survival. However, when they kind of started teasing out the molecular populations, they actually found that the biggest benefit appeared to be in that population that was P53 wild type, which makes sense because, you know, what selinexor does is it traps those tumor suppressors in the nucleus. And if you have an active tumor suppressor, so a functional tumor suppressor, P53 as a wild type, it's of course going to have the best activity. So it's very exciting. And there is a confirmatory trial coming down the pike. And those of my friends who see patients with GYN oncology diagnoses, I hope you'll open it because I think it might be a very nice definitive study and offer a nice option. From a standpoint of tolerability, I see the adverse events here in front of me. You know, overall, it's very well tolerated. Nausea is the biggest thing, but I think we're working on utilizing really prophylactic antiemetics to make sure this is tolerable for the patient population, which is, of course, very important when we're talking about maintenance.
The thing I really loved about this paper, and I've been hearing from you all about the subtypes, and also I want to ask you about POLE, which is something everybody asked about, but they actually looked at the benefit based on the subtype. There's a pretty significant difference, and I guess in the quote, copy number low subtype, really low hazard rate, you know, 0.16. You see maybe endometrial studies moving more in this direction, looking at the different subtypes.
100%. I mean, we're discussing this in the context of several of the phase three studies that have just completed because this wasn't done in we didn't break it out by these four subtypes in a prospective fashion. And so can we move back and look at those things? But I think going forward, you're going to see a lot more of this. There's actually some really cool studies that are ongoing, including a study called Taper and a study called Rainbow, where they're, you know, directing therapy based on whether the patient's in a given subtype. And that'll help us understand which subtypes really need treatment and what potential treatment might work best. And to get at what your question was around POLE, there are some thoughts that because that group does so well, do they need anything, right? So can we avoid treatment in that patient population? We don't know the answer to that yet. What we don't know is, do they just respond really well to whatever we give them? Or could we avoid giving them anything at all? I think that's the question that we don't know the answer to that hopefully some of these studies will answer.
So yeah, I have oncologist Sam looking for POLE. I've never seen it. Can you talk a little bit more about what it is? So it's even more mutated than MSI high, right?
Yes, they can have upwards of 50-100 mutations. It's unreal. I can always tell when you get next gen sequencing, I can tell it's a POLE mutant before I even get down to the POLE part because they'll literally have a mutation and it's like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You know, their tumors are so ultra mutated. And what we think is that because there's so many mutations that they just respond so well, it basically handcuffs the cancer and they respond really well to whatever we give them.
So Shannon, thank you so much for joining us today. Audience, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk about PARP in ovarian cancer. Thanks, Shannon.
Bye. Thanks for having me. Take care.